This podcast brought to you by the full-time and part-time graduate business programs of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. Powerful network, legendary brand. That's Notre Dame Business. Learn about our graduate programs in Chicago and South Bend at mendoza.nd.edu.
New research from the World Bank suggests just four nations are winning the global war for talent.
This is Your Money Matters from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome to Your Money Matters. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York. The world's highly skilled immigrants are increasingly living in just four nations, the U.S., U.K., Canada, and Australia. That's according to new research from the World Bank. Joining us now with the story is the Wall Street Journal's Adam Crichton. Adam, you say the research highlights the challenges of brain drain for non-English-speaking and developing countries.
Yes, that's certainly right. I mean, look, if these countries, the four countries you just mentioned, if they are effectively hoovering up the smartest, the best and brightest from the poorer countries, then that's going to affect the growth rates of those poor countries in a negative way. It's not certain. I mean, it could be the case that those people do return to those countries after they've spent some time abroad in the US or the UK or Australia, etc. But so far, the evidence suggests that they do tend to stay. So that is a negative for those countries.
For some perspective here, in 2010, around 70% of engineers in Silicon Valley, 60% of doctors in Perth, Australia, were foreign-born. That's absolutely unbelievable.
It certainly is. The fact that really shocked me the most, or that surprised me the most, was the surge in the number of women. Female highly skilled immigrants who have moved to those four countries, to the OECD, from poorer countries. That it grew 150% to 14.4 million between 1990 and 2010. So that's a much, much faster growth rate than the world's population, and it's a faster growth rate than the exodus of highly skilled men. And I thought the explanations were very interesting. I mean, a researcher at the World Bank basically hypothesized it might be because women in these poorer countries still don't, they're still discriminated against. They don't have as privileged a position in society as the men do, and so they may well have a greater incentive to leave than their male counterparts.
But I'm wondering how that also changes these countries by taking the highly educated, highly skilled women and mothers out.
Yes, well actually, certainly the World Bank economist posited further, who I spoke to, he said that had a very deleterious effect, if you like, on as he put it, the civility level of these societies that the women were leaving from. These are the highly educated women, so are presumably more tolerant, more worldly, less likely to be politically extreme, and they are leaving the country. So I suppose, the one side effect of that may well be that the overall population left behind is going to be less open-minded and perhaps more easily swayed by extremism in politics.
It's also interesting to me to note that this is happening when both the cost and ease of communication, really also perhaps travel, are so much lower and easier than in the past.
This is another really interesting aspect. I mean, certainly it's the case that transport has been getting cheaper and cheaper now for many, many years, for 50 years or more. So that would of course suggest that immigration throughout the world would increase. But on the other hand, we've seen more recently in the past 10 years or so, the cost of communication has absolutely collapsed. And so the implication of that might be that there's less need to move, that people can stay where they want. They don't have to live in London or New York to be engaged in whatever employment they want to be engaged in. So we're really seeing in the growth of immigration, the dominance, if you like, of the transport factor, of the cheaper transport factor, that seems to be dominating the countervailing pressure, if you like.
It's interesting that from wherever you are, making a meeting that's especially important or a conference in some other part of the world is just not as hard as it used to be.
Yeah, well, certainly that's true. Some of the other economists I spoke to when I was thinking about this piece, they argue that actually, Facebook and email and things like this, they actually hadn't had as much impact on kind of workplace structures as we may have thought. And, one professor I spoke to cited his own university and said the vast bulk of emails in his university are between people physically at that university. And he said most organizations are actually like that. So although it seems like email and so forth can enable very disparate groups of people to work together, there's something about human nature, at least, that likes to be physically in proximity with our colleagues.
Very interesting. Now, governments have different ways of controlling the flow of labor, but you say in your piece that formal restraints might be less effective than they seem.
Yeah, that's right. So at the moment, advanced countries tend to have two general ways of controlling skilled immigration. There are point systems, which are used in Canada and Australia, and so that is where a potential skilled immigrant presents themselves to the government of that country, if you like, and then they're evaluated according to their work experience, to their education, to their English language skills. And then, on the other hand, some countries have a system more like the United States does, where the government effectively leaves the decision to the private sector and says, look, if you want to hire a skilled immigrant, then you choose them, and then you make the case to us that you really need that skilled immigrant. And so they are the two different ways of doing it, if you like. And the authors were not clear as to which one was best, because they both have their strengths and weaknesses. But they did make the somewhat amusing point, I thought, that at the end of the day, you know, people will find a way around either of these systems. And, you know, one of the main ways of doing that, of course, is to marry someone from one of those countries. And they actually volunteered themselves as an example because they had done that. So I thought that was
both.
That was quite funny. Well, there were four authors. Two of them, I believe, had married U.S. citizens. So
I thought that
was very amusing. Yeah.
Anything else surprise you in reporting this piece?
Yeah, look, I mean, it surprised me that until 4 years ago, I think, or 3 or 4 years ago, the UK was the dominant supplier of skilled immigrants, and it was also a destination country. So it was both of those things. And I thought that was very interesting. And, of course, now it is fourth in line, the UK. So India is first with 2.3 million highly skilled immigrants living elsewhere, and then Philippines, and then China on 1.5 million, and then the UK on 1.5 million, just a little bit less. So that really surprised me.
Definitely a surprise there. That's the Wall Street Journal's Adam Crichton. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Your Money Matters. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.
For more podcasts, check us out at wsj.com/podcasts. Become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and now look for us on the Google Play Music app on Android devices.